At the end of the 2006 NFL season, Los Angeles Raiders wide receiver Randy Moss was unhappy. And when Moss was unhappy, he typically did not play well. That season, he had been often criticized for dropping passes and giving up on routes, and in fact told the media that maybe because I'm unhappy and I'm not too excited about what's going on here, my concentration and focus level have gone down because I've been in a bad mood. Now, this is a receiver that Tom Brady would go on to call the greatest downfield receiver in the history of the NFL. In fact, Moss ran a 4.25 40-yard dash. He had a 51-inch vertical jump, all doing this while being 6'4", running wild in the secondary across the NFL for a decade up to this point. On the day of the NFL draft in 2007, Bill Belichick and Al Davis had been going back and forth over terms for a trade for Moss to come to New England. Now, there were a couple hang-ups in the deal, one of which was that Moss was going to have to waive a significant amount of money for his deal to be able to fit under the salary cap in New England. Now, Moss had been accused of being a malcontent before that, both in Los Angeles and for the Minnesota Vikings, having been accused of spraying referees with water bottles, insulting the media, skipping media sessions altogether, mooning the crowd in Lambeau Field in Green Bay, among many other offenses that happened behind the scenes. And many wondered if Moss would be able to fit in to the culture that was created in New England. However, at the time, Belichick thought that Moss's willingness to give up $21 million that was owed to him by the Raiders to come across the country and catch passes from Tom Brady for a mere $2.5 million indicated that he was really all about winning, and at this point in his career, really did just want to experience the Super Bowl and chase a championship ring. Now, over the 3 years that Moss played in New England, he set the NFL record for touchdown receptions in a season in 2007 with 23. He led the NFL in touchdown receptions again in 2009. He had three 1,000-yard seasons and was part of one of the most explosive offenses in NFL history. But as the team prepared for the 2010 season, Moss was once again unhappy, and unhappy with the contract that he signed in year two that would pay him $9 million a year for 3 years in New England. Now, prior to the first game of the season, he told reporters at CBS that he was frustrated with his contract, that he did not feel that he was wanted, that he didn't want to go through the season not knowing what they were going to offer for his services following that year. And so he aired his grievances publicly, which is something that was never done in New England. To make matters worse, over the coming weeks, Moss would continue to complain publicly to the media about his contract status. Now, one of the tenets of the Patriot Way behind the scenes is that players do not talk about their contracts publicly. There are often spats and fights and disagreements with agents and players and owners, but it's always handled behind the scenes and is considered to be family business. And here Randy Moss was violating this sacred standard of the culture in New England multiple times to start the year. And so, after the fourth game of the season, Belichick and Patriots owner Robert Kraft had one final conversation about Moss, and they traded him back to the Minnesota Vikings for a fourth-round pick. Not because he couldn't catch the ball, not because he was failing to do his job, but because he violated one of the critical standards of the Patriot Way. Now, this week on the podcast, we're going to talk about the issue of accountability, what it is and what it isn't, when it works and when it doesn't. And while many of us would look at this situation and the way that the Patriots handled Randy Moss's complaints and think, man, I wish I could do that when my players got out of line, we know that that simply isn't reality for those of us who are coaching at the high school or collegiate level.
Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast, brought to you by Thrive on Challenge. I'm JP Nurbin, joined by my friend and co-host Nate Sanderson. Each week in about 30 minutes, we discuss important principles and strategies of transformational leadership. At Thrive on Challenge, we help coaches to raise the standards and strengthen the relationships in their program because we know this type of culture produces better leaders, better people, and better results. To learn more about how we can help you, go to thriveonchallenge.com, where you can also subscribe to our weekly newsletter and get the coaching notes to every episode of this podcast. So Nate, that story about Randy Moss, the Patriots, and his departure, it's just one example of what I might call extreme accountability at the Patriots. Like, it doesn't matter how talented you are or how many touchdowns you have caught, or if you've helped them win a Super Bowl in the past, if you do something unacceptable, they're going to send you packing. Now, I think for us as coaches, stories like that, they're impressive because we know so many other coaches, sometimes even ourselves, who may not have had the courage or the fortitude to hold a high prospect like that accountable. It's also impressive and admirable because that type of accountability, it's not only lacking in sports today, I think it's lacking in our world in general. So I think it's tempting or appealing when we hear stories like the Randy Moss story for us to think, man, we as coaches, we need to start applying extreme accountability in our own culture, right? It works. It works for the Patriots. It's going to work for us. But that's an oversimplification of how to create a great team culture. Also, it doesn't account for several factors, right? First off, most of us are in far different circumstances than Bill Belichick, okay? Secondly, there is more to what the Patriots do than just send guys packing when they fail to meet the standard, right? The Patriots aren't just about accountability, and we'll talk about that in a second. But why? Why aren't they just about accountability? Because accountability, and I use that word in the traditional sense of the word, or how it's used in coaching, accountability is overrated. I know that might start a fire in some coaches. Some might feel like that's blasphemous, but it's true. If the only way we work to create our culture is through accountability, where as soon as someone steps out of line, there's a consequence, then we're running the risk of three things happening. First, we are running the risk of creating a culture of fear. Now, you want to see what happens when your culture is all about accountability? I would highly recommend checking out the HBO series Chernobyl or just studying up on the Soviet Union. Great example there. At best, people will do the right thing in this culture because they're going to get rewarded. But in a lot of cases, and in most cases, they're going to do it because they want to avoid punishment. Secondly, we are running the risk of just becoming the accountability police, not a coach, not a mentor towards our players, but just being the accountability police, which if you are a coach, you know that gets exhausting throughout the season. But possibly even more important than those first two things that I mentioned, the negative effect of a culture that relies heavily on accountability is that you will fail to help a lot of individuals. I mean, so many people will come into your program and they're going to struggle to meet that standard. They're going to lack the habits or character to meet the standard in our program. And if we only hold them accountable, they won't make it because they need something else. They need support, which that's going to be our focus in today's conversation. How can we support people within our program?
Well, JP, while that statement that accountability is overrated is sure to get your Twitter followers fired up a little bit, I think there's some other important distinctions between the level that we coach at as high school or collegiate coaches and what's done at the professional level. And consider the relationship between the organization and the players to begin with. At the New England Patriots or at the professional level, that's a transactional relationship. They bring Randy Moss in. His job is to score touchdowns. They pay him to do that. When he doesn't meet that standard of performance or he crosses a line culturally and doesn't uphold the standards, you know, in the locker room, complaining about his contract, whatever it might be, then the agreement, the transaction is terminated and he's let go. But when we talk about the distinction between a transactional coach, someone that is using their players and their athletic abilities to further their own goals or ego or agenda, whatever it might be, and the mission of a transformational coach, which is to take a young person, to have them play for you in your program for a year, 2 years, 4 years, whatever it might be, and come out on the other side as an improved human being, then a transactional approach that just says, here's the consequence, you either meet it or you don't, doesn't necessarily produce the lasting change that we aspire to as transformational coaches. And, you know, one of the other analogies that as you were talking at the beginning there, it made me think of is that when we're teaching our players a tactical or a technical skill, you know, where they're learning a new piece of the offense, we're trying to get them to block a certain way, to finish a certain way, to kick the ball a certain way, we typically approach those as learning and teaching moments, right? So we're recognizing that there is a deficiency in skill, and our reaction to that as a coach is to teach in a different way or to reach them in a better way or to provide them another opportunity to learn the skill that they need on the court or on the field for them to be successful. But too often when we think about those cultural skills of being a great teammate or being selfless or being a good leader, we think, oh, JP's a captain, but he's not leading or he's being negative in the locker room. So immediately I go to consequence rather than thinking this is a learning and teaching opportunity for JP to learn a skill that he currently lacks. And how can I do that better as an educator to help transform who he is so that he's able to do that on his own rather than just in response to a consequence that I hand down?
Nate, that's such a great kind of metaphor or comparison when we talk about, you know, our character or that character of our players, you know, of just, are we working with them on that just like we would work on any other skill? And I think for the longest time, I said, well, I'm not going to coach attitude or effort, you know, can't coach effort. And we can have that attitude as a coach, but I don't think it's going to help us to be really, really successful. I think the other aspect of the Patriots culture that's probably not highlighted as much is how they do support their players. I mean, I've had the privilege of knowing Jack Easterby, who was their character and culture coach that was brought in around 2012. And we had him on the podcast around episodes 35 and 36. And one of the things that he said back then, 2 years ago to me, that has stuck with me to this day is that accountability is just accounting for one's ability. So when someone comes to the Patriots, his role was to see where they were at. What was hard for them? What did they struggle with? And this could be things beyond the football field, you know, beyond running routes. It was things off the field or in the locker room that could have been detractors from the Patriots' performance. And so he had to really assess them as far as their character. He had to assess them as far as their emotional intelligence. And he had to then try to work with those individuals to raise that and to support them in that. It wasn't his job as the character or culture coach to come in there and start running out, you know, consequences and stuff like that. That wasn't his job. His job was to come in there and to support and work with their players on some of those character skills.
So JP, as we go forward in this conversation, I just want to be clear to the listeners that we're not going to muse philosophically here for 30 minutes, but we do want to share some really practical stories from coaches in our program about how can we approach our standards of behavior and our standards and our culture a bit differently in a way that goes beyond just consequencing behavior. And I know you've got a couple of great stories here that really help to illustrate a different approach that some of our coaches are taking.
Well, one of my favorite stories from just last season was Coach Cerrone up at Sussex Hamilton High School in Wisconsin. And he told the story to coaches in the TOC community on a recent, you know, roundtable back during the lockdown. But I'll tell it here today. It's an incredible story of how accountability is not always really even needed. So Coach Cerrone had been working with me through the mentorship program, and early in their season, they're one of the best teams in the state of Wisconsin at the 5A or 6A level. They've got the number one prospect in a senior class, playing for them as well. They're going to win a lot of games this season. They're going to win by a lot. And they are, you know, early on their first few games, they're crushing opponents by 30, 40, 50 points because they're really, really talented. But after those first few games, Coach Cerrone was really kind of upset about how his players were responding in those moments where they'd make a big play, they'd make a three-pointer, they'd have a dunk, or just being up by a lot. He didn't think that they were acting in line with who he wanted them to be, or even really who they wanted to be, right? There was just a lot of showboating. There was a lot of, you know, looking to the crowd. There was a lot of kind of dancing and all that. And it was really a lot of unacceptable behaviors. Now, traditionally, what this would happen, a coach like myself, we would might come in and we would give our team a lecture. We'd get a lecture about how that's not acceptable and how they need to cut it out. And if they don't, you know, there's going to be some sort of consequence. But Coach Cerrone and I, we kind of drew up a different type of team meeting. And in fact, he met with just his captain's council the next day. And what he did was he just asked them, when you make a big play, when you knock in a big three and have a big dunk, or when the team is up by 30 or 40 points and we're just really putting it on a team, who do we not want to be as a team? What type of behaviors are unacceptable, not in line with the identity of this program? And he had some phenomenal players, not just players, but he had some phenomenal leaders and great young men on his team. And honestly, they nailed this part. They were very clear. We shouldn't be dancing. We shouldn't be looking at the crowd. And so they started with just the unacceptable behaviors, who they didn't want to be. And then he asked him, okay, who do we want to be in these moments? Who do we want to be as a program? And they were really quick to outline some behaviors as far as, you know, sprinting back on defense, acknowledging the passer, playing really hard, after the game, shaking hands, letting the other team know they did a good job, and just being good sports, you know, practicing good sportsmanship. And that was it. Those captains then, they kind of recapped those things about who they wanted to be. They recapped those things on who they didn't want to be. And then coach just said, now I want you to go and share that with the rest of the team. And that's all they did. Now, remember the day before when we're planning out this kind of intervention with coach, being tempted, as many coaches would be tempted, to think about the consequences. Like, okay, if they don't meet the standard here that they outline, then we need to communicate the consequences. But we decided, I think probably Coach Cerrone's credit here is, you know, to hold off on that. You know, like, that is that necessary? If they don't meet the standard, then we'll deal with it then. You know, but let's just start with them kind of revisiting and doing a bit of a review on this standard on how we are going to operate when we're winning big, when we're making big plays. And so we just left it at that. And here's the most amazing thing about this story is that Coach Cerrone never, ever had to bring this up again. The players knew who they wanted to be. And all he had to do was help them to remember that. All he had to do was help them to self-reflect. Were they the team they wanted to be in those moments? And they were like, no way, that's not who we want to be. And that was enough. The rest of the season, they went on to play really, really great basketball. They were real big contenders for a state championship before COVID came in. And it just never became a problem. And Coach Cerrone didn't have to be the accountability police. He didn't have to give out. He didn't have to yell or scream or give lectures. He just helped them to self-reflect and to self-correct.
And I think it's important for coaches to understand that this wasn't the first conversation that they'd had about their identity or wrestling with this question of who do they want to be. And there are a lot of different ways that can be structured, you know, whether it's who do we want to be? What do we want to be known for? How do we want to be perceived? What do we want, you know, people to think about when they think, you know, hear the name of your program? But really, it all comes back to this question of identity. And once a team has been able to wrestle with their aspirations of who they want to be and what values they want to be known for, then this is just another way to call them back to that in a way that's not punitive, but it's more reflective of, are we embodying those values right now? And I think this approach is powerful because it ties into these identity statements. You know, James Clear in his work talks about if you want to work out more, it doesn't start with a calendar and check marks and stickers and rewards and consequences. It starts with an identity statement that says, I'm a guy that doesn't miss workouts. Like that's how I see myself. That's who I want to be. And so then the behavior all comes back to, am I in line with that statement? I'm a guy that doesn't miss workouts. I think, JP, of a story about, this is all the way back in the 1990s when Gary Barnett took over the Northwestern football program, you know, probably the worst football program in Division I for much of the 80s and 90s. And one of the identity things that they really preached to their players was, we want to be resilient. We know that we're going to be challenged. We know that we're up against these, you know, blue blood programs, the Michigans and the Ohio States and the Hawks and, you know, Wisconsin, all these great teams in the Big Ten. But we want to be a team that's going to play for 60 minutes. We want to be known as being resilient. And what was interesting about how he unpacked that is that they talked about behaviors. They talked about similar to what you described here. What's it look like? What does it not look like in practice and in games and on the sideline, et cetera. But they also had a little bit of a secret metric in the locker room. And the challenge that he put forth to the team was, we're going to have a huge celebration the first time somebody in the media writes a story about Northwestern football and uses the word resilient. And sure enough, in that season when they went to the Rose Bowl, I think it was 1990, 4 or 6 or whatever it was, about midway through the year, they played Purdue and they came back and won the game. And the beat writer for the Chicago Tribune says, "What a resilient football team." And the point of that was that this identity that they had been talking about was finally seen from the outside looking in, because their behaviors were in line with who they wanted to be. And I just thought that was a really powerful way of changing that culture and guiding them to become, you know, a team that went to multiple bowl games there during his tenure after being one of the worst football teams in the country for decades.
I love that story. And it makes, I'm going to say something here as well that might rattle some other coaches, but core values are overrated, right? If he had just picked, "We're going to be a resilient football team," and gave it in a fiery speech at the beginning of the season and posted out resilience on the back of their t-shirts, it would not have had the same effect. What we're talking about is in Coach Cerrone's situation and the story of this Northwestern football program is that they continuously revisit those values and what they look like in these moments, or they're continuously and rewarding or looking for opportunities to highlight where they were resilient in the program. And I think that's just a really powerful thing. It's not enough just to have, "Hey, this is who we want to be," but you continuously come back to that. I think that's really important.
And to me, JP, the thing that was powerful about that is they weren't convincing themselves that they were resilient. You know, they were trying to reach that standard so that somebody on the outside that doesn't know the secret would use that word to describe their team. Think about, you know, going back to Jack's definition of accountability, they're trying to account to that to such a level that a stranger on the outside, that would be the first word that comes to mind to describe this football team, and how powerful that perspective is in not necessarily reining in behavior, but in focusing a team on who they want to become, and it being so obvious that it can be seen from the outside as well.
And I think that's one of the powerful things when you're kind of even defining your identity is to ask, how would you want other people to describe this program or this team? I think that's a powerful piece of this. Now, just revisiting your values and revisiting the behaviors, you know, the unacceptable, acceptable behaviors that you aspire to in your program, that's not always enough. Just recently enough, and on a great story worth sharing today, I think, is a story of Coach Tyler Wright down in Georgia in a small high school down there. His girls' high school basketball team had a great offseason. In fact, the best offseason they had as far as the weight room. But when the school year started back up, they really started to struggle. And so me and Coach Wright, you know, talked, and we planned a very similar intervention that Coach Cerrone did with his team. But we added another little element that I think is sometimes really, really important, and that is empathy. Why were they struggling to meet the standard that they had set for themselves in the weight room? And when we unpacked that, we kind of came to this realization, this is really tough for them right now. They are back into school after being out of it for 4 months. They're wearing masks all day in school. They're in the weight room. It's very, very chaotic. There's multiple teams up there. It's a girls' high school basketball team, but they've got other male teams in there, which poses challenges for their focus, for their energy, and their effort being at the standard they want it to be. And so we first off, we stopped, we paused, and we just tried to empathize with those players. And then, you know, that team meeting, yes, it did look very similar. You know, they revisited the standards of the weight room. But then he added this element or this question, which was, what's keeping you all from meeting the standards that you guys set this summer? And there they were able to articulate those obstacles, those challenges that he kind of knew about, but just allowing them to name those, that was really, really important. And then it was, okay, well, how are we going to overcome those things? How can I help you? And so they put in a little bit of a mini plan to overcome some of those obstacles by working in groups and little kind of units so they could hold each other accountable. They clarified how they should hold each other accountable, how they could help refocus each other when they were struggling with focus, when they might be distracted or their effort might drop. And they really had this very clear plan of how they were going to overcome those obstacles, but they came up with that together. And here we go, another example of providing some, you know, them an opportunity for them to self-assess, to self-reflect, but then also self-correct, but do that together with the support of the coach. And he didn't have to give a lecture once again about the consequences for them failing to meet the standard that day. It was just, go out here, let's go be who we want to be. And when we struggle with that, let's help each other out. And that, I think, is way more powerful than if he had come in there and given them some big lecture and threatened to run them or kick them out of the weight room if they didn't meet the standard.
And a couple things to add to those examples, JP. Number one is these conversations don't have to take long. It isn't an hour-long meeting where everybody's got to sit down, right? You know, it's something that can be done in 10 minutes before you go into the weight room again. It can be done 10 minutes, you know, before your regular pregame talk when you're asking your team, who do we want to be when we're ahead or when we're celebrating, and what do we want to communicate to the fans and, you know, to the opponents and the officials by our behaviors. And I think that sometimes can be a barrier for coaches to engage in these conversations, is the fear that, oh my gosh, we got to find time, you know, for another long meeting. I think the second thing that both of those stories kind of reveal here is that, you know, it's really the difference between tapping into an intrinsic motivation, who we want to be, how we want to be seen, you know, how we want to be known or what we want to be known for, versus reacting to an extrinsic motivator, which is the consequence or the penalty or the coach yelling or the sprints. Or what have you. And I think you and I and all of our listeners can relate that we're going to be more engaged, we're going to be more motivated when we're operating from a place of intrinsic motivation rather than reacting to what someone else is trying to impose upon us through consequences or other outside motivators. And JP, next week on the podcast, we're going to continue this conversation and talk about progressive consequences. In other words, are there ways that you can have incremental interventions as you're evaluating your standards in regard to a person's behaviors? Thinking about Randy Moss, would there have been something the Patriots could have done other than just you cross the line and you're cut? And we'll get into that next week. But before we can go down the rabbit hole of progressive discipline, I think we have to really attune our minds to the idea of progressive supports. And the stories that you've shared this week have been great, not just as another way to hold players accountable, quote unquote, but it illustrates a different approach. In other words, those coaches are asking better questions rather than what can I do that will fear them into doing the right thing. They're asking, what can I do to support them? Are they lacking something that either they can provide for each other or that I can provide for them to accomplish what we want? And when I think about this in a parenting context, you know, I've got a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old at home. Both kids are now going to school, you know, so we pick them up at 3:00 and we get home. My wife comes home from work at like 6, so we typically don't eat dinner until about 7:00 at night. My kids eat lunch at school at 11:15 in the morning. And so sure enough, 4:30, 5:00, you know, we're going through nuclear meltdowns here. And there was quite a while where I was thinking, we're going to learn long suffering. Our kids have to learn how to be patient. They don't always get what they want. That's what life's going to be about. And I'm giving these speeches to my 3-year-old and 6-year-old as they're complaining about being hungry. And then, of course, their behavior is just unruly. They can't get along. We've all been there. What I realized over the last couple of months is that if I just gave them something to eat, if I offered a support first, all of a sudden there is so much more peace in the Sanderson household from 4:00 until 7:00 at night. So we just have the 4:00 shake, you know, with fruit and vegetables every afternoon. And all of a sudden, everybody gets along better because I started asking myself a better question.
Well, I think what's really important about that story is I'm sure you're not just giving them the shake and then they get to act however they want. You're helping meet their needs so that then you can hold them to certain behavioral standards that are not picking on each other or getting in fights, and they do listen. But I think it comes back to a little bit of one of my favorite books, which is From the Whole Brain Child by Daniel Siegel. And he says, sometimes it's not that they won't do it, it's that they just can't do something. And when kids are really hungry or when kids are really sleepy or when our athletes are experiencing certain difficulties and obstacles and challenges, it's not that they won't do it. It's just sometimes they struggle to be able to do it, whether they lack the emotional intelligence, whether they lack the character. And it's our job to try to help meet some of those needs so that they then can meet the standard of behavior that they've agreed to and that they want to live up to. Now, I think so much of what we're trying to do when we're offering support comes down to the research from Gabrielle Oettingen out of NYU around WOOP, which is Wish, Outcome, Obstacle, Plan. That essentially goal setting isn't enough. It's not enough just to focus on the wish or, you know, that outcome that we want to achieve in anything in life, whether it be a good grade on a test or to improve skills in a sport or just, you know, lose weight. But we need to focus on the obstacles to that. So what are the obstacles that are keeping us from achieving the thing that we want to achieve, to becoming the person we want to become? What are those obstacles? And then how can we make a plan to overcome those obstacles? And then her research is phenomenal. And that's really what we're trying to do here, is we're trying to help our players to not only identify who they want to be or what they want to achieve, but what are the obstacles that are keeping you from achieving those things or doing the things that you need to do to achieve those things. And when we come in there and we help them to identify that obstacle and then help to remove that obstacle, it really ties back in so much to her research around that.
Well, JP, as we wrap up this week, you know, some coaches out there may be thinking, well, that's it. We just don't consequence our players at all. We just have these little 10-minute meetings and everything's going to be, you know, we're going to live happily ever after. And we know that's not the case. There are going to be times where a player's behavior doesn't change as the result of these supports or one of these conversations. And we know that some of these player behaviors can do damage to your culture. They can do damage to the relationships in your program and undermine the standards that you're trying to establish. So next week on the podcast, we're going to talk about that middle ground. What do you do after you've had some of these supportive conversations, but maybe before reacting like the Patriots did and just cutting a player loose?
Now that's it for today's episode of the podcast. Thank you so much for listening in. If you found today's episode or any of our episodes to be beneficial, we'd ask this of you. Just take 60 seconds, leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcast, share this episode, share other episodes on social media, or just text them, email them to a friend out there in the coaching community that could really benefit from our message.